Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
The legendary German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck supposedly said, "If you like laws in sausages, you should never watch either one being made." Now, I love sausage. Sausage is terrific. But the making of the tax bill was ugly to watch, even though Republican leaders attempted to keep much of the process as secret as possible. Nevertheless, the more than 500-page bill represents a major rewrite of the tax code, something we have not seen for decades. There is so much to cover here that we'll have an hour of analysis with host Joshua Johnson at 10. But we want to dedicate the rest of this hour to hearing from you. What are your questions about how this tax overhaul might affect your family or your business? You can give us a call at 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828. You can also reach me online by tweeting to @CFarrellEcon. Here to help you answer your questions are two experts. Kelly Erb is a senior editor at Forbes. She's also known as the Tax Girl. She joins us today from Philadelphia. Welcome, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And Jared Walchek is a senior policy analyst with the Center for State Tax Policy at the Tax Foundation. He's in Washington, D.C. today. Jared, thanks for being
with
us.
Good to be with you this morning.
So I want to ask both of you just the same question. I'll start with you, Kelly. In essence, this tax package offers a permanent tax cut to corporations, temporary reductions to individuals. And it's a complex behemoth with many moving parts. But what do each of you believe is the core change in this bill? I mean, what would you want to emphasize about this bill? Kelly?
Well, oh gosh, you're exactly right that there's a lot in the bill that you could talk about. But I think that the thing that I kind of took away from this is that it really does focus on corporations more than individuals, even though that's what we're saying, you know, that it's supposed to be benefiting middle-class families. And I think that really when you start looking at the individual components, even though you mentioned at the top that it's going to be temporary for individuals, I think that the shift is going to be more towards a permanent cut moving forward. So, you know, I think that it's kind of complicated to sum up things in one little bit, but I think that the thing that I keep saying is, you know, keep quoting Scorsese, that simple is hard. I don't think this became any more simple than what we had before, but I do think moving forward, we are going to see some lower rates.
Okay. So, Jared, the same unfair question to you.
Yes, well, on the individual title, the individual side, certainly the benefit is for middle-income families and particularly those with children. But Kelly is absolutely right that a lot of the big changes are on the corporate side, and those are designed around two things, and they really run in tandem. One, making the U.S. more competitive with the rest of the developed world, and two, changing some of the incentives for investment. This isn't just about, say, cutting taxes for corporations. The idea is to change what corporations do and put more investments within that realm of things that are worth building towards.
Okay, so let's focus on the corporate tax rate. So dropping the rate from 35% to 21%, I mean, that doesn't seem to be that much out of line. I mean, those numbers were out there. President Obama, I believe, had proposed 28%. But Kelly, one of the things that, you know, it's been a sort of a long time, what do you call it, adage in the tax reform business has been you lower the rates and you get rid of as many deductions and credits as possible. So it's, you know, broadening the base. Now, my sense is, yes, we lowered the rate, but there wasn't a whole lot of change in terms of limiting the sort of deductions and credits on the corporate side. What is your sense? I mean, am I wrong about this?
Oh, no, I think that, I mean, there are some key provisions that I do think are definitely going to affect corporations in terms of what they can deduct and some things that have gone missing, and specifically some of the incentives that they normally offer to their employees are no longer going to be deductible. So I think it's going to change the way that corporations do business on the one hand, but I don't think that in terms of as you mentioned, eliminating significant outside of some research and other credits, I don't think that there's going to be significant change other than those cuts in terms of broadening the base. I think the most honestly, the most significant benefit to corporations actually was how we rewrote how we think of the tax base in terms of global versus territorial. I work with a lot of international clients in my firm, and I know that that's something that's really been talked about a lot in the international community. So I think that's more significant. But I agree that I don't think that there was, the change, as you mentioned, really didn't happen in that realm.
Okay, Kelly, here's the challenge. Very quickly, the difference between global and territorial.
So we're one of the few nations in the world that our companies were taxed on their profits no matter where they made them. So if I am located in India and I make my profit in India, but I'm a U.S. corporation, I still get taxed on those profits. Other companies do what they call a territorial system, which is where you just get taxed where you're where you make your money. So we're changing the way where we tax. We used to say that if you're a U.S. company, we're going to tax you everywhere. Now we're saying that that's not going to happen.
Jared, I want to jump to the change in the pass-through businesses like S corporations. And everything I'm reading from the tax experts is that this is where the tax code has become more complicated. This is where we're going to see a lot of gamesmanship opportunities, is what how the pass-through businesses are going to be treated.
That's unfortunately absolutely true. You know, there's two different types of simplification. One is just the paperwork, the filing and the compliance.
Right.
And there are some changes on that. The other form of simplification is whether you change tax planning. Ideally, a tax code raises revenue and does as little as possible to change the economic activity that someone participates in. There are some good things on that on the corporate side. Unfortunately, the opposite on the pass-through. What we're going to see here is a lot of tax planning, where people try to reclassify income to take advantage of this pass-through deduction. This is going to mean more people choose to become an LLC, become a partnership, become simply a sole proprietor, a subcontractor. And it's going to mean some changes in behavior that are designed around taking advantage of a tax benefit rather than growing their business. And that's unfortunate.
So let's go.
And I'll just jump in and add that we already started getting significant inquiries about whether or not people should incorporate, whether they should change their form of entity. We joke, President Trump said that he wanted to put HR Block out of business. But I will say that I think that this is actually the Keeping Tax Professionals Employed Act, because we've received a number of inquiries exactly as Jared just said, about should I be a pass-through now? Should I change my form of business? So I think that how we view corporations and pass-throughs is going to be definitely affected.
Yes, like that famous scene in The Graduate, the movie, where the guy says plastics. So that's where young people should go into. I think for young people, the word is taxes. There's a lot of work there. Now let's go. We're getting some calls here, so I'd like to go to Peter in St. Paul. Peter?
Yep. Hi, thanks.
What's your question?
It's kind of a comment more than a question, maybe. I think we'd be better off if, instead of giving the money back to the corporations, if the government used the money for infrastructure expenditures, and if they built green energy to support their own governmental facilities, that would save tax dollars. And I'm worried that the next hurricane, and they're going to have to spend hundreds of billions of dollars for the next hurricane on a coastal city. Where is that money going to come from if the government is running without enough revenue?
Okay. No, I think there's been this long-term debate about, the United States needs more infrastructure spending, and if we want to get jobs, that should have been the focus rather than cutting taxes.
Well, good news, bad news here for your caller. It's been a long time since the federal government has made determinations on spending based on whether it would increase the deficit. And I suspect that even after the tax reform package, that's not necessarily going to affect a lot of these decisions. But listen, I mean, there are lots of governmental investments that can be made that can have an effect on GDP. When you look at what the tax reform bill does, the one thing I would emphasize, there's the reference of tax cuts for businesses, and that's absolutely true. There's a 35 to 21% rate differential. But you look at a lot of the emphasis on the corporate side, especially with the provision called full expensing. The framework here is
designed— And just quickly define full expensing for everybody.
most businesses, you know, when you have a business, you deduct most of your costs. You subtract those out and you pay on your net, essentially your profits.
Right.
But your investments are different. It's different than, you know, your compensation and everything else. You actually amortize those. They are across the depreciation schedule. You eventually deduct it out, but over as much as 39 years. So you don't get the full benefit of that initially. It's a bias against investment in the code. And that is eliminated for some classes of property. So basically, you're getting rid of some of the bias against investing. And the key here is you're only getting that benefit if you're expanding your business. And to me, that's the good part of this. If you're providing the tax benefit predominantly for businesses that are expanding, that are looking for new opportunities, and that's where you see real growth.
Okay. So there's a good follow-up question, I believe, from Carrie in Madison, South Dakota.
Yep.
So what is your question, Carrie?
You know, I'm actually wondering how this new plan kind of compares to what I've read as trickle-down economics, I guess, and also a little bit more on what trickle-down economics are and what we've seen in the past with it. And, you know, are there concerns or, you know, positives that could come from it?
Okay. So what do you think, Kelly? Is this trickle-down economics all over again? Deja vu all over again?
Well, in fairness, I'm a little young to remember some of the trickle-down economics. But historically, the terminology means that if you give a big cut at the top, that it eventually will benefit those at the bottom. That's kind of the ideology behind it. And, and a lot of people have said that. I don't know that it's fair to say that this entire package is the equivalent of trickle-down economics, because there are some pieces that are very clearly geared towards helping those who are already at the middle class and the bottom end of the spectrum. So it's not just all, you know, we've been hearing a lot in the press, this is all, you know, for people at the top. There are some real benefits that are going to happen for individuals, as Jordan mentioned earlier, at the middle and even towards the end, things like doubling the standard deduction for people who don't itemize. That's actually a plus. For those who do itemize, that might be, it's kind of when you start looking at the limits on deductions, that's maybe frustrating for them. But the doubling of the standard deduction, outside of the elimination of the exemptions, because that could have some, depending on the size of your family, some different results. But, you know, the child tax credit, the expansion of the child tax credit, they kept the earned income tax credit in place. So, when you hear people talk about how this just benefits people at the top, it's very clear that people at the top are going to get a plus. I don't want to downplay that because, you know, that is happening. But it's not a tax package that's written just for those people at the top. I personally don't always, and I work with a lot of high dollar and high wage earner individuals and corporations. I don't always believe that just because they do well means that someone at the bottom is going to get the benefit. But I do think when you talk about things, as Jared mentioned earlier, like expensing, you're broadening the opportunities for the tax relief to affect more different sectors and more different taxpayers.
Okay, so what are your questions about how this tax overhaul might affect you? We have two experts, Kelly and Jared, to answer your questions. Give us a call, 651-227-6000, toll free, 800-242-2828. And let's go to Shirley in Maple Grove. Shirley?
Yes, my question had to do with the child tax credit, what its impact. My understanding with the child tax credit, as I recall at least, is there's an age limit. Child tax credit had a limit of either 17 or 18. What's the impact then on people who have children that are college age that they support and they declared them as dependents so that the $24,000 might not bring them as much? And secondly, they typically were able to declare them as dependents, which will that stay in place for things like, things that had to do with providing them with part of the tuition and,
right,
and child support and claiming some of that.
Okay, so Jared?
Sure. And Kelly might want to jump in here with more details. The child tax credit has never been available to anyone other than minor children. So that doesn't change. That's not been available to children in college at any point. What changes on the child tax credit is the amount increases from $1,000 to $2,000. And a much more significant portion of it is refundable, meaning that even if your tax liability is such that you'd be paying little or no taxes, you can actually get a check back from the government for the difference. So $1,400 of it per child is now refundable. It also extends to an unlimited number of children. At some point for many taxpayers now, the additional child tax credit kicks in. It's less generous. There are some phase outs. The phase outs are now much higher. So far more families get to take advantage of that. There's also a there's another like a per person family tax credit of $500 available. So other dependents who are not children qualify for the child tax credit can take advantage of that. What you're losing is the personal exemption, but you're gaining the much larger child tax credit and this new family tax credit.
Kelly, anything to add?
Yep. Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that part of the confusion on the ages is that, and you actually alluded to this at the very beginning, that, you know, this tax package was although this is something we've been talking about all year long, you know, Chairman Brady, this is something that has been long something that he's wanted to accomplish. It really did kind of happen very quickly, and there weren't a lot of details that were immediately made available. And when you started hearing the details on the House and the Senate packages and then the conference bill, there was talk, and I believe it was in the Senate bill, of raising the age under the child tax credit. And when it was made law, it did stay under the age of 17, which is actually, as Jared referenced, not a change, but it's a change from what was proposed. So a lot of people heard that and assumed that the law changed, and it didn't. It actually just what the criteria for dependents has not changed, and the ages have not changed. What changed was the amount of the credit. But because there was all of this talk about raising the age, I think that a lot of taxpayers conflated that with a change in the existing law. And then the other thing I was going to mention, that family tax credit, not only would it be available potentially for kids in your household who are in college, for example. But it also includes adults, which has been something that the tax code did allow before, but was a little, I think, less generous and more confusing about. So, for example, if you're supporting parents, which increasingly a lot of folks are now, this additional $500 family credit might be available to you if you're taking care of either parents or aunts or someone else. So, I actually think that, you know, I know that Senator Rubio, he really pushed for this in exchange for his vote. I do believe that the expanded child tax credit is actually a good thing for most middle-class taxpayers, and especially, as was noted, the expansion at the base. A lot of what, you know, there's a lot of confusion and controversy about what's considered middle-class anymore, but a lot of people that would consider themselves middle-class but were at the top were phased out of being able to take advantage of the child tax credit. But now you can be married and make up to actually over $400,000 and still be able to take advantage of the credit. And that's a big change.
That is a big change. Now let's go to Carrie in Moira, Minnesota. Is Moira right?
Yeah.
Okay. So Carrie, what is your question?
Does it make sense to prepay real estate and or income taxes in Minnesota this year?
Jared, there is a rush. Carrie's just hit on one of the questions. There appears to be some kind of a rush to prepaying taxes. What are your thoughts?
It makes sense to talk to your tax preparer about it. There's no simple answer, and it's going to vary by taxpayer. I'm a little concerned that in the rush of localities across the country that are trying to encourage people to take advantage of this, that people may make poor decisions. Because remember, we still have, especially under current law, an alternative minimum tax. So under next year's taxes, there will be a $10,000 cap on the state and local tax deduction. So some are saying, well, I'll prepay them now, I'll take care of it this year, and I'll get no cap. But remember, if you end up hitting the alternative minimum tax, you get $0 in the state and local tax deduction. And it's very possible if you are significantly increasing your deduction that you may in fact hit that. So check with a tax preparer. It may be a good strategy that can save you some money, but if you're not careful, it could actually lose you a lot of money.
Yeah, I think that's a really important caution because, I mean, this is a 500 plus page bill and people are still poring over it, trying to figure it out. There's some poorly written language in there, a lot of uncertainty. And Kelly, I want to ask you, there's a follow-up question. Christine, she had called in earlier, and her question was, she's already paid her 2018 property taxes. If she has the money to pay her 2019 property taxes, should she?
Well, my gut would be to refer back to Jared and say, you know, absolutely talk with your tax preparer. But I would say she probably can't. And I actually want to loop back into the prior question, too, just to clarify two points.
Yep.
One is, under the bill, Congress anticipated that people wanted to prepay. And you're actually specifically prohibited from prepaying income tax. So I know the first caller asked about income and property tax. You cannot prepay your income tax. You can prepay possibly property tax. And here's why I don't think the 2019 scenario works. The rules under the existing law, because again, the existing law didn't change, just the caps basically on this. You can only pay taxes, property taxes, you can only take the deduction for those that have either been paid or accrued. And under the tax laws, accrued generally means when you're billed. So, you know, and some of the language says imposed, but for property taxes, it's paid or accrued. So that's why you have people like in New York, for example, the governor issued an executive order directing local municipalities to issue property tax bills for 2018 early so that those folks have those bills in hand so they can argue to IRS that those bills had already been accrued and therefore they could pay them and still have it count. I don't know that there's any argument that you could make that 2019 taxes have already been imposed or accrued.
Right.
So I think that that's jumping the gun a little bit. So even if there were a tax benefit, even if the AMT and all of those other pieces didn't affect you, I do think that you may be limited. And then another point just to make is that, you know, we go through this even with or without tax reform. We go through this discussion every year. Like, what do you pay at the end of the year? Do you prepay your mortgage? Do you prepay your taxes? Like, what can you do in advance? Keep in mind that when you do that, really what you're doing, because and this is why it makes sense to talk to your tax professional, is you're just accelerating all the tax consequences. So if you prepay 2018 and 2017, which may make sense for you, you know, depending on who you are, what do you do in 2018? Now, do you prepay 2019? Because you've already paid 2018, so you've lost the deduction in 2018.
Right, and you just have to think about alternative uses of the money and whether this is the best use of your money. But I want to go to...
You want to make sure you're not losing the deduction to begin with before you go ahead and burn it.
Right, and I want to go to Jennifer in St. Paul. Jennifer?
Hi, yes. I know a lot of independent musicians and who also happen to... drive for like delivery for Amazon, and so they're filing their taxes as independent.
So they're gig
contractors.
Economy workers.
Yes, exactly. How does this affect them? Could you explain a little further on the itemized deductions work?
I'm glad you asked this because more and more people are in the gig economy, freelancers, sort of this contingency workforce that is growing. Jared, how does the So this would mostly be the pass-through aspect, right, that would have an impact?
It would be. And I think that itemized deductions matter less here. Many of these individuals may choose to take the standard deduction now that it is higher. And the caller may be thinking about, say, unreimbursed business expenses. But it's more likely you're going to run this all through your pass-through. You're going to be a sole proprietorship or something like that. So you're going to have those business costs built in there. And pass-through businesses are going to be able to take advantage of a 20% deduction against the first $157,000 worth of their income if they're single or $315,000 if they're joint. Above that, it's actually still available, but there are some limitations both on like industry type and on some on a cap on up to 50% of your W-2 wages or some amount of capital. So it's still available, but it gets a little more complex in terms of whether or not you can take it. But probably the average person participating in the gig economy is going to be able to take a 20% deduction against all of that income. And that's going to be very significant above and beyond the changes in rates.
Kelly, one question I want to ask you is with the doubling of the standard deduction, which means fewer people are going to be itemizing, what is the impact of this for, you know, median income? I know that's controversial. What is a what is a middle class income? But for median income, middle class income in terms of their charitable gifting?
Well, that's actually been a point that a lot of people have been very concerned about, because I think that, you know, I do a piece every year at the end of the year. I do a series called 12 Days of Charitable Giving, where people write in about their favorite charities and we focus on them. And inevitably, every year when I do this, I get these angry emails to me that tell me that I shouldn't be touting the tax benefits of charitable giving because people should give anyway. And statistically, that's actually true. By the numbers, not by the dollars. If you look at the numbers, most people who give to charity don't take the deduction. So, you know, when you look at high dollar giving, that's a different scenario. But, you know, the people who drop the money into the, you know, the bins outside of for Salvation Army and people who give to their church, and a lot of these people aren't, they're never at the level that allows them to deduct from their itemized deductions anyway. So, you know, that impact, a lot of that is psychological. I think what the real concern is, though, is those folks that we were talking about earlier, the folks who take advantage of the state and local deductions. You know, when you're right at the edge, if you're deciding what can I claim,
right,
that's when the smaller deductions, like if I now write a $1,000 check to my college, all of a sudden, it now makes sense for me to do that. If I was debating before, do I give them 500 or 1,000? Now I'm like, you know, why don't I give them more? Because I can deduct it. So if fewer people can take advantage of the deduction, I think we're going to see a dip in those deductions overall. Because again, even folks who might have been on the edge or might not have been able to claim it, psychologically, it's sort of like the mortgage deduction. You know, people sometimes buy more houses than they can afford because they think the tax piece will make up for it. I think it's the same way with charity. I think a lot of times when we give, you know, you drop off the books at the library, you get the receipt that maybe you lose and you never even claim it anyway, but you did it because, oh, I get the tax deduction.
Right.
I think there'll be less incentive to do that. And I think that's what charities were rightly concerned about, is that I don't think that, you know, I don't think it affects the taxpayer numbers as much as we think. Like, I don't think you're going to notice, unless you're a fairly heavy charitable giver, I don't think that you're going to notice a difference. And if you're at a high dollar level, it's not going to make a difference
because
you get to keep it. But if you're right there in the middle, I think, you know, I think it's more psychological. But it is going to affect, I think, what the charities give at the end of the day.
Jared,
if I could jump in here just briefly,
yeah,
on that.
Yeah.
So firstly, just emphasizing what, you know, Kelly said, those from $45,000 to $60,000 give about 3.7% of their income charitably each year. You don't actually reach that level again until you reach $5 million. That's perhaps a really sad commentary on American society, but Kelly's absolutely right that the vast majority of givers are already not claiming this.
That's
the
right.
Other thing is that there are two different factors that are going to affect your charitable giving. One is, of course, what the tax benefit will be, that maybe if you only have to pay 75 cents on the dollar rather than the full dollar per dollar you give, that makes a difference. The other aspect, of course, is how much disposable income you have. And the tax bill will mean that the vast majority of taxpayers have more disposable income. That's going to have the opposite effect. That can increase charitable giving that might offset some of those losses within that band where you're not taking the deduction anymore.
And Jared, we got a note from John. He's in St. Paul, and he's wondering if they kept the senior deduction for persons over 65?
Yes, they did. That's kept as is. And of course, you can also take the higher standard deduction along with that.
Okay, so
that
you're just weighing between it. Yeah.
Sorry, I was just going to add that one of the reasons, that's one of the top questions I got, because I actually did write a post where I said that we kept it, and I can't tell you how many people wrote and told me I was wrong. And the reason for that is because both originally, both versions, and again, this goes back to how the bill was put together.
Right.
The idea of doubling the standard deduction initially was to absorb the loss of the personal exemption and the additional standard deduction. But in the end, the additional standard deduction remained.
Okay. So now let's go to Little Falls, Minnesota, and John. How you doing, John?
Good. Thanks for taking my call. This is a great discussion. You know, we've been talking a lot about how the new tax plan affects individuals and corporations, but I'm wondering, on the other side of the equation, what your panelists think, how this is going to affect, you know, programs for the poor, research and innovation, employment at the federal level, all of those things that actually have huge benefits for society as well.
Okay, so they're not going to give me another hour, and I'm not going to let our guests have another hour, but this is really a key question, and I think it's one of the echoes that we're hearing right now is, you know, we can't afford the farm bill. We can't afford to be doing, we can't afford various programs. So I'm going to start with you, Jared. You know, getting at the nub of John's question, what do you think the effect is on other programs?
It's an important and it's a difficult question, because Congress for a long time has made these decisions relatively independently of where the national debt is or even where the deficit is. But obviously, these are things weighing on their mind. And if there are losses here, then they may choose to offset them elsewhere. I'm not sure politically how significant that will be, but it's important. And it's also important to note, you know, a lot of the programs we talk about that government provides, they are not going to provide the same growth that tax reform does, but that's not the only metric to measure them on. You know, a lot of distributions to, say, the elderly, they're not growth-oriented. You're going to get more growth out of a tax cut, but we care. You know, this is important to us. You know, not everything is about growth. And
right.
Politically, we have to make these determinations. We need growth in the economy because it helps pay for these things, and it also helps reduce reliance on a lot of government programs. And I think tax reform was well overdue. It's been 31 years coming, and we were out of step with the rest of the developed world with much of our tax system. But there are a lot of really important government programs. And I think in the coming years, with or without this, we're probably going to have a serious discussion of entitlement reform and other changes. But we have to keep all of those things in mind.
Kelly?
Oh, I will completely echo that. I think that there's no doubt that we're going to hear a lot in the coming year about spending and priorities. I mean, one of the issues that this bill did raise is that, you know, does it or does it not pay for itself? I think the consensus outside of Congress is that it will not pay for itself. So I do think we're going to see some spending cuts. And then the question becomes, where do we make those? So I think, you know, as you mentioned, it could be another whole hour discussion. But it really, I think it's going to be a really interesting 2018 because it's also an election year.
All right, let's go to the phones and Reverend Zuku. Did I say your name right?
Yeah, Reverend Zuku.
Ah, well, what is your question?
Thank you for taking my call. My question basically focuses on the church endowment and nonprofit organization attached to the ministry in America. Well, I hear a lot of people talking about personal gain, businesses, and personal taxes. But as we all know, that when the government hand cannot reach to help the citizen, the church, the religious, and nonprofit pick it up from there. So we know that when it comes to filing tax at the end of the year, there is some a benefit and a repayment that is given to those organizations. And I have two questions. That's one of it. I want to know if there is any changes in that area, if the taxes go up, refund go up, or it's still the same, or is limited, or is removed.
Okay.
You know, that's one of my questions. The second question is, I know we have some clue about the Johnson Law concerning the religious era of America. In the Johnson Law, it states that you can't tell your congregations how, you know, they should discuss matters
right.
of the government that affects them as
yep.
citizens. If you do, a religious organization can lose their 501c3. And Mr. Trump, the president, said that for so long, they are being unfair to them because they are
okay. I'm gonna interrupt you here now. We're gonna get to the answers. I think we know what the question is here. Kelly, as far as the Johnson Law goes, brief definition of the Johnson Law, and was anything done with that?
Sorry, so there was an attempt to include some provisions into the tax code that would change the way that we treat churches and other charities that may have religious and or political influence. And those did not happen. The law that he's specifically referencing, as he noted, is that if you are a 501c3 organization, you're not allowed to endorse or oppose political candidates. That's basically the rule, or you could lose status, and that came into controversy recently. There were no changes. There were attempts to change that, but there were no changes in this law.
So that's a good example of where there were things were proposed but didn't end up in the final package.
Right. And the reason that actually, if you go back to the controversy at the end about everything having to match up, one of the issues that's raised is that a tax bill that's introduced the way that this one was introduced can only directly address tax provisions. So you can't throw in, or you're not supposed to throw in, other non-specifically tax or revenue-related provisions. And so the argument was made that that was not appropriate for this bill.
Jared, I want to throw the last question to you. And it's a little bit unfair because we don't have much time, about a minute left. But it's from Rick in River Falls, Wisconsin. On the corporate side, do you think that the money corporations held overseas will be repatriated back to the U.S., which was one of the big things with the tax bill?
A significant amount will, not as much as perhaps under the original proposal, because those repatriation rates are now pretty high, 15.5% for cash and cash equivalents, which is high enough that it'll keep some overseas. But some of it will come back because they will take advantage of that rate, and more importantly, because there will be more investment opportunities in the United States. You always have to consider what is the return on investment, and tax costs are part of that consideration. Now that tax costs are lower and you do have the ability to fully expense your capital investment, it makes more sense to bring more of that back to the United States and invest here, and the repatriation regime helps that. So you'll definitely see a lot of it.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for your time. Kelly Erb is senior editor at Forbes. She's also known as the Tax Girl. Jared Walczak is senior policy analyst with the Center for State Policy at the Tax Foundation.